This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
I'm delighted to be here tonight to launch the Origin Speaker Series in the cozy confines of Artifact Coffee. This gathering is intended to elevate the conversation about food, its origins, and what is happening around our food system in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We started our first restaurant, Woodbury Kitchen, with a commitment to local sourcing and now work closely with more than 60 different farmers and growers throughout the region. We supply our four restaurants and our canning and butchery operations with meat, eggs, grains, fish, shellfish, cooking oil, cheeses, and produce, literally everything we need to feed our guests. The hope is that this series will shine a light on the work that farmers and producers are doing in our area. The conversation is being held monthly at Artifact, our coffee shop in the heart of the Woodbury neighborhood in Baltimore. Tonight's conversation is about oysters and aquaculture in the Chesapeake Bay. And now I'd like to turn the program over to Jim Porras, the former senior editor at Food Arts Magazine.
Before I say thank yous and give introductions, I just want to establish my oyster bona fides, so you know that I really like oysters. And I'll just tell you one story. Back when I was dating my wife, every New Year's Eve we would go to some strange place in New England that was really cold and forbidding and go bird watching and take a couple of bottles of scotches and some cheese and some bread and just have a great time. It sounds very romantic, but basically we froze. And one year we went to Cape Cod and we stayed at a little inn, and I said, let's go up to Wellfleet, and, you know, just walk around. And as we got to the dock in Wellfleet, an oyster boat was coming in, and it was piled high with oysters, 10 feet high on the deck. And I said, we got to buy some of these right off the boat. So the guy hadn't even docked yet. And I would say, hey, you, can you sell some oysters? He said, yeah. So I said, how much? I said, about a penny a piece. Good. I'll take a couple dozen. So we took him back to our little room in the inn, and all I had was a beer opener and a little sink in the bathroom in which to wash them. And, you know, after I kind of massacred my hand trying to open them with a beer opener, a bottle opener, we had oysters, and they were great. And I've had a lot of oysters since then, but I really, really, really love oysters. And we have a lot of people here tonight who know a lot about oysters. So I'm going to introduce you to some of them in a little while. But first, I want to thank Spike for, you know, having us here and initiating this series. I think it's going to be a good one. And we have two more coming up, one on February 19th and one on March 19th. So don't forget to tell your friends to buy tickets for those, and you come back. So we're going to have this spill over to the outside. I also want to...
Is there a theme identified for each of those nights?
Well, we will tell you at the end of the program. I also want to say thanks to Hannah Reagan, who coordinated this whole affair tonight. She gave us Artifact After Dark program, and she's been very instrumental in getting this off the ground. There's others to thank. Corey Poloka, Director of Operations at Foodshed, and Aubrey Brooks, Director of Reservations. You probably dealt with them in coming here. I also want to thank the chef who's going to be cooking tonight's meal, Opie Crooks, for serving and preparing an oyster-themed dinner. Also, over here in the corner, we have the Broadcasting Institute of Maryland and their students for volunteering their services to record and edit tonight's program, because it's going to be showed up. It's going to show up on Heritage Radio, and it's going to be broadcast as a podcast on Heritage Radio. For you, those who don't know, Heritage Radio was started by. It's out of Brooklyn in Roberta's restaurant. You probably heard of Roberta's because they're kind of famous for pizza and other kind of hipster food out Bushwick. And it's a great radio station focused on food issues. And they've had everybody on. I actually appeared on there myself. The last thing I did at Food Arts, they called me up and said, what do you think of Food Arts closing? And I said, all right, this thing is wonderful. And I also want to thank Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee of the Heritage Radio Station, who kind of helped negotiate the broadcast here. And I also want to thank Sean Noche, who for all the flowers that you see tonight. And there is one other person we need to thank, and that is Dana Slater, because she thought of this whole thing. So now to our panelists. First is Arona Cobell. She's a reporter for the Chesapeake Bay Journal, which is a free newspaper covering Chesapeake Bay watershed. She is, I told you, I like oysters. She is nuts about oysters. You know, she named her first child Oyster. Her second one is going to be Shell. I spoke to her last week, and it's like, you know, we could have talked days about oysters. She knows a lot about oysters. Second panelist will be... Second panelist is going to be Matt McShane of the... tell me if I'm pronouncing this right. Can you pronounce it for us?
Great Wicomico.
The Great Wicomico Oyster. It's located in where in Virginia?
It's in the northern neck of Virginia, which is down a little bit. If you look at the Rappahannock, it's the next notch above. So.
And his third panelist is going to be Dewey Ward, who is kind of a sidekick because he does to the Great Wicomico Oyster Company, because he does something very unique for their operation and very special for the bay. So I'm going to turn the first mic over to Rona, who's going to provide a lot of background about the history of oysters and oystering on the bay up to present times. Rona?
Okay, so there's a lot you could start with oysters. You could talk about restoration, you could talk about history, you could talk about food, and I know a lot of you are in it for the food, and that's great, but I like to talk about oysters because I think that the oyster, the Chesapeake Bay oyster, tells a story about resilience, and it's actually a true underdog story, to borrow a line from the movie Dodgeball. I'm going to start at the beginning, that oysters were a foundation food for the Native Americans and the colonists, and they were eaten at Jamestown, and back in the 1700s and 1800s, there were a lot of oysters shucked all around the Chesapeake Bay, and they were canned at canneries in Baltimore and put on trains and sent all over the country. And most people, when they ate oysters, ate a Chesapeake Bay oyster. And then we started to see the first depletion in the 1800s of oysters. And part of the reason for that was because other places were also depleted, and the New Yorkers and the New Englanders came to the Chesapeake Bay to take our oysters, and they used a very powerful piece of equipment called the oyster dredge. And oyster dredges scrape the bottom of the bay and they take everything. And so Maryland in 1820 banned the oyster dredge. And in 1830, it banned non-Marylanders from oystering in Maryland. In 1850, just to give you a ballpark, the oyster harvest in the Chesapeake Bay was at 1 million. And in 1865, because oysters were coming back, Maryland watermen convinced Maryland General Assembly to reinstitute the dredge. So the dredge came back, and the total bay harvest got to 5 million. And then 20 years later, it was 20 million. And that was the time, you might have heard of the Oyster Wars, that was the time that oystermen from Maryland and Virginia were fighting each other across the Potomac over oyster beds. Oystermen from New York and New England were coming to take the oysters that they could get, and using kind of getting people here to register their companies and doing all kinds of shenanigans so they could oyster here under local names. And it was becoming clear that something had to be done because this was not sustainable. So in about 1900, there was a lot of pressure on both Maryland and Virginia to get into aquaculture. And Virginia decided to take the plunge. They went to a leased bottom fishery. So what they did was basically, for a nominal fee, you could lease a few acres of bottom, and you had to seed it yourself and put the shells down yourself, and then it was yours. And you could use what equipment you wanted. You could harvest it when you wanted. It was something, it was your business. Maryland went in another direction. Maryland decided to make the oyster harder to catch. So in Maryland, they went to the skipjack. So they had these kind of inefficient but very pretty boats. They had days where you could oyster in certain creeks and equipment that you could use in this creek and not in the other. And some of that still exists today. There's tributaries in Maryland where you can only hand tong or you can only dive. And that dates back to the time when these rules were set up to basically make oystering less efficient so the oysters would be around. In 1949, a big game changer came to the Chesapeake Bay in the form of a parasite called dermo. And Perkinsus marinus is the scientific name, but we all call it dermo. And it devastated the Chesapeake Bay oysters in both Maryland and Virginia. But in Maryland, there was a belief that dermo was more potent in the high salinity areas of the bay. So the watermen in Maryland convinced the Department of Natural Resources to move the oysters from the salty part to the fresh part to give them a chance to live. But what happened is the disease spread. So we spread disease all over the bay. It was here, but we made it worse. Virginia was suffering from dermo as well. But then in 1960, another parasite came in called MSX. And this was absolutely devastating in Virginia because it was a more high salinity parasite. So in some of these leased oyster beds, which oystermen had seeded themselves and put their own money in, 80% of the crop was lost in some of them. And it was just completely devastating. And a lot of the Virginia oystermen decided they were done with oysters and they got into clams. And because the Virginia oystermen are so entrepreneurial and smart, they turned clams into a $30 million industry. Much of it was by Cherrystone, which you might have heard of the Cherrystone clam, and now Cherrystone is big into oysters too. So throughout the 1990s, there was this push in Virginia to put in a different species because the native oyster wasn't really doing it anymore. It just couldn't live. And so they decided to bring in this species called Arikensis, which is an Asian oyster. It's not the same Asian oyster that brought in the MSX in 1960s. It's a different oyster. And what was said about this oyster over and over again in the early aughts is they taste good, they grow fast, they don't die. That was the rationale. So Virginia, because it has this aquaculture culture, wanted to put in a sterile Asian oyster. So this is an oyster that has three chromosomes instead of two, and it doesn't reproduce. And because of that, you don't have to worry about a lot of ancillary diseases or other, you don't have to worry about it overpopulating, and you can control it. And at first, Maryland was not interested in the Asian oyster at all. But then in 2002, Robert Ehrlich was elected, and the watermen wanted this Asian oyster, and he said that we could take a look at it. So Maryland began investing money, and Virginia was already investing money in an Asian oyster. And Virginia hired a top oyster geneticist from Rutgers named Stan Allen, who had actually developed the pioneering technology to make a sterile oyster back in the 1970s when he was a student at Rutgers. And they brought him to Virginia and they said, help us make an oyster. So he came, and this is where things really, where one small decision really changed the course of a whole industry, in my opinion. They were going to do the experiments with native oyster, reproducing native oysters called diploids, and Asian oyster triploids. And if they did that, essentially the game would be rigged, because a triploid oyster grows three times as fast as a reproducing diploid oyster. And so a very smart scientist at NOAA said, we'll give you the money to do the experiments, but you have to do triploids to triploids, apples to apples, oysters to oysters, or we're not giving you the money. And so they agreed. And everyone just sort of assumed the Asian oyster would do better because there were pictures of them in China. They grew as large as dinner plates, and everybody thought that the Asian oyster was going to do better. But what happened was they were all wrong. The native oyster did better because the Asian oyster had three problems. Probably one of the biggest for Spike and people who care about food is that the shells were thin, so they gaped open. And so they were fine for shucking, but they really weren't good for the half-shell market. They didn't have any kind of shelf life. They also were susceptible to a worm called Polydora that for some reason just didn't like the natives. And the third thing, which is important for a restoration, the same scientists who insisted upon the apples-to-apples comparison sent a top oyster researcher to China to investigate how these things build reefs in China. Turns out they don't build reefs at all. So for a restoration type of thing, it wasn't going to work too well because the whole rationale for putting them into the bay is they would build reefs, they would create habitat, they would help crabs hide from predators. So Stan Allen was very excited about this, but he thought he could do even better. So he took the technology to Virginia's five oyster private oyster hatcheries, and he said, look, you know, I've made this triploid. I can make it to market size in about 18 months. Can you do better? And they said, we'll try. And they managed, through their breeding programs, to get a triploid oyster that could grow from seed to market size in 1 year, and in some places even less than that. So you have the reproducing native oyster that grows about an inch a year. So a 3-inch oyster, that's market size. And then you've got, and probably won't make it because of the disease. And then you have this super oyster, this triploid, that is just muscular and tasty and can go the distance. And so Virginia put this into practice pretty quickly. And they now have, let me see. I got to look at my notes here for a second. They have a $22 million oyster industry now. Half of it is from aquaculture, and they have 100,000 acres under lease in Virginia. So meanwhile, Maryland is looking at Virginia and thinking, why can't we have this? And Governor Ehrlich sort of cracked the door open on aquaculture. He got some things started. But the law, it was still basically illegal to lease bottom in Maryland. And there had been efforts to change that law over the century, and the watermen had always fought it. And so Martin O'Malley said in 2007, how come we don't have an oyster industry here? And the answer was, because it's illegal. And he said, well, let's change the law. So they did. In 2009, it became legal to lease bottom in every county in Maryland. It was previously only really happening in one county, and that was Wicomico County, not Wicomico, Virginia, but Wicomico, Maryland has the Nanticoke River, and there was a big oyster company there that was leasing. And in 2007, there were 6 oyster companies in Maryland, and I knew all of them. And now I'm happy to say that I don't know all the oystermen in Maryland because there are too many. And we have now 4,000 acres under lease. We have 318 leases. And so I guess the reason I like to write about oysters so much is because you meet these people who have dreamed of leasing bottom their whole life and they get to do it. And you meet people who have been oystering their whole life and they're looking for something to give to their son or their daughter so that they can continue in the water business. And you have people who are looking to bring ecological benefits back to the bay. But to me, the story of the oyster is a story of resilience, about proving people wrong, because the best oyster for the Chesapeake Bay, the one that could taste good, grow fast, not die, build reefs, create habitat, and repair our bay, it was right in front of us all along. It just needed a little genetic tweak.
Thank you, Rona. Thank you. Oyster farming and aquaculture centuries and centuries old. The Romans were famous for it, and they farmed up and down the Italian peninsula and wherever they went. And to this day, some of the old Roman oyster beds are still being farmed in Colchester off the coast of East Anglia in the North Sea in England, and produces some of the best oysters in England. So those are oyster beds that are farm oyster beds that are over 2,000 years old. And so now we're going to go to Matt McShane, who actually is an oyster farmer. He'll tell you what he does and how he got into oyster farming. Matt?
Thanks, Jim. Before we start, I just wanted to say thanks to everybody, Spike, Dana, and everyone who put this together. It's really been fun over the last month or so preparing and getting to figure out what we're going to talk about and what the importance was. As Ron was saying, the importance of the oyster in the Chesapeake is basically one of the things that creates reefs. And does anyone know much about a filter feeder or how much an oyster might eat? I mean, I know how many oysters I can eat, but no? All right.
Well,
Okay, about two or three dozen. An adult oyster will filter up to about 55 or 60 gallons of water a day. So if you can imagine all the oysters sitting around the bottom of the Chesapeake, you know, filtering out all of the algae that makes the water green. The rumor was that when John Smith first pulled into the Chesapeake or sailed up the Chesapeake, you could see the bottom 50 feet down. There was no sediment. There was very little algae because the oysters were eating it all. The oysters were also back then considered not a food group but a navigation hazard. Because the reefs would pop up through the water and you have a wooden hulled boat and next thing you know, you're swimming. So what we do and how I got into oystering was basically my father was a huge oyster fan. He's a native Marylander. Family came from not Baltimore, but Balmer. And every time we'd go out, we'd go to the Tillman Island Oyster Festival or St. Michael's and we'd sit down and try and outdo each other with eating oysters and I'd be ashamed to tell you the quantity I could put down. So that's where it started, and then I remember taking a tour of a shucking facility where there's this pile of oyster shell, and I remember them saying, put those in the water and you'd have babies. And I'm like, baby oysters? Like, how does that work? So I started looking at that, and became really obvious that that's the substrate or the hard surface that an oyster larvae will strike on and then start growing. It's not like they were all just sitting there waiting to go in the water, but that was the substrate. We started the Great Wicomico Oyster Company about 5 years ago. We're based in Virginia on the Great Wicomico River, which I'd mentioned at the beginning is just above the Rappahannock. It's the next river, major river below the Potomac. And what we do that is a little bit different than other farmers, if you look, 95% of the farmers in Virginia actually raise triploids only. And the triploid oyster is because you can eat it year-round. Have you all ever heard of the myth that you can only eat oysters in R months? Well, that was because during those months where there's an R, they're doing something very unique. They spawn all summer long. So a native oyster, a diploid oyster, will spawn all summer long, and the meat turns a little bit yucky. Not yucky. It's not hazardous. It's nothing more than it's just not firm and tasty. So the triploid you can harvest year-round. 95% of the farmers in Virginia do triploids only. We're one of the only farms that actually does diploids, so the breeding oysters, and also the triploids. And the reason why is although it does take longer to get a diploid to market because they do breed in the summer, we found that it was more important to introduce genetically strong material back into the bay. So most of our larvae that we get, which are no bigger than, say, the ground pepper kernels that you'll get tonight on your pepper shaker. They start out that big as one-eyed larvae, and we strike them on ground-up oyster shell. We'll buy 4 million larvae at a time, and out of that we might get close to 800,000 to a million baby oysters that are no bigger than, they're smaller than your fingernail. So after a while, within a year, those oysters will start becoming viable as far as breeding. So the oysters start out mainly male. By the way, does everyone know what a hermaphroditic organism is? Okay. Just want to let you know. I didn't want to go into the gory details. But they mostly start out as males. By the time they hit two, most of the oysters have turned into females. So you have young males and older females. And a female oyster will put out over 200 million eggs in a breeding season. And oysters are also, and the reason we do this, oysters are community breeders. So if you can imagine breeding, if you have a decimated oyster population, once you have an oyster 10 feet away from another oyster and another 10 feet away, when it comes time to breed, the mechanism by which they signal each other like, hey, it's time, we're not really 100% positive, but we do know that if you're 10 feet away and you're an oyster and you can't move, it's really hard to get a date. So what we do know is that if they're in one cage and you have 100 or 200 oysters in a cage and they are all diploid, when they go to breed, they're all as close as we are at the table, if not closer, and they breed. And, you know, 200 million eggs hit the water. They then be, you know, sperm meets egg. You get a one-eyed larvae. And so if you looked at our farm in front of the dock, we have anti-erosion riprap. All that rock is covered with oysters at this point, mainly because of our own oysters that we raise. And by the way, the Woodbury Kitchen is the only one that actually gets those oysters right now. So we worked with Spike on that one, and they now call them here strikers, I believe.
Yep.
So we do things also a little differently. Maryland has laws that allow you to float a cage on the surface, usually made a PVC ring with a mesh in the bottom, and they hang out there. Virginia considers that a water hazard or navigation hazard for boats. So our cages have to sit on the bottom. They can't be any more than 1 foot off the bottom, which is weird because a crab pot is about 2 feet off the bottom if everyone ever sailed into one. But anyway, I'll get to that story later. So our cages all sit on the bottom, and what we did is we invented a different type of cage. Instead of the big square cages, we use a cylindrical cage that allows you to tumble the oyster actually within the cage. So in oyster aquaculture, when you see these oysters, you'll notice they have a deep cup and a flattish type top. What that is caused by is the knocking off of the growth bill on the oyster's lip. And it's kind of like the reverse, I hate to say this, of an ingrown toenail, like you wear a shoe that's too tight. What this does, it makes the oyster deeper, it has more liquor, more tasty, and a thicker meat. So what we do is we tumble those actually not only through a tumbler from Chesapeake Green Technologies, I'm looking over at Dewey Ward, but also inside of the cages. And the current cages are mesh covered with vinyl. The ones that we have right now, thanks to some connections Dewey had, are actually made of recycled Coke bottles. So it's a plastic cage, recycled. We sell those to what we call oyster gardeners, so the people that actually hang cages off their dock, but also we use those, or will be using those commercially as well.
Our next speaker is Dewey Ward of Chesapeake Green Technologies, and he works very closely with Matt in a kind of in very special ways that benefit Matt's oyster farming, but also the bay itself. Could you explain, Dewey?
Yes. Well, thank you for having me. As it was pointed out earlier, I'm basically a sidekick, so glad to be a part of it. We do a lot of things very closely together. I met Matt before he started his oyster company, so we go not way back, but back far enough.
Back far.
Like you mentioned, the oyster cages, the oyster sorter. Those are both things that, you know, Matt came up with ideas. I'm a process engineer, chemical engineer by trade. And, you know, we talk, bounce things off one another and try to come up with different ideas. How can we make this work? Like you said, with the cages, I've spent a few years in silicone, also done some work with injection molding. So that's where we came up with that idea. You know, how could we get this more recycled material, more mainstream, be able to, you know, not sit there with a hog ring, you know, putting these metal cages together. So came up with the idea of processing and, you know, making it a little bit easier and also being environmentally friendly at the same time. And the nice thing about those is them being cylindrical, you can roll those on the boat while you're out there. And you can just throw them back in. You don't necessarily have to sort them at the time. You can just roll them, which is good for the growth. The tumbler itself is a stainless steel tumbler that we make. We sell. Design that's for sorting. So essentially, if you're getting them to market, you need them all to be a certain size to get to market. So in order to do that, you need to sort them and know when they need to be pulled out. So that's another thing that you can do out on the boat. Runs on a 12-volt molder, 12-volt battery. Which is powered by a biodiesel Yanmar outboard engine, which is really where Matt and I started. So we met through UMBC's biodiesel club, and, you know, I was making biodiesel. We had some ideas of how that could benefit the bay and his oyster company. He has an outboard diesel engine, and we can run that on biofuels. Luckily, we have Woodbury Kitchen, who adds oil, which is a waste product. We're able to turn that waste vegetable oil into a fuel that Matt uses to harvest oysters. And the nice thing about biodiesel is when it starts coming down to emissions, a lot of the things that have come into play in the last 7 years, they've really started cracking down on. They've done a lot of changes to engines, and that's because of the emissions of diesel. Now, if you had just made a change like they did with ethanol, 10% ethanol, which everyone hates because it's a bad product from a functionality standpoint.
And from an environmental point.
Well,
we can get into that.
Not here to talk about biodiesel, but yes. From my point is they went in a different direction with diesel emissions, and they started changing engines. And but if you were to just implement, say, like a B20, which would be a 20% biodiesel, 80% diesel blend, you'd see a 20% reduction in unburned carbons, 12% in carbon monoxide and particulate matter. Depending on the engine, which is where I was heading towards in the beginning, you can either see a reduction of 2% or an increase of 2% in NOx. And most studies, when they say you go to B100, you actually see a 10% increase in NOx. And NOx is either a nitrogen oxide or a nitrogen dioxide. But everything else is substantially less. So you go to B100 and you've got 67 less unburned carbons, 48 less carbon monoxide, and 47 less particulate matter. But again, that 10% increase in NOx. Now, what I like about working with Matt here is if you take that negative, what you would think for your NOx emissions, and you put it into the bay, what you see is nitrogen oxide and nitrogen dioxide is naturally converted into a nitrogen trioxide or a nitrate instead of a nitrite. And that's actually consumed by your plant life in the bay. And once your plant life uses that, it's completely gone. It's absorbed. Like, it does not exist. It's actually providing food for these plants, which, as Matt stated, is then consumed by the oysters. So you're feeding the algae, which is then producing food for the oysters. You know, everybody wins.
And you cut your greenhouse gases down, what, 70, 80%?
Yeah, it's the numbers are huge. So it's been a lot of fun working with Matt. Started as biodiesel. We've certainly branched out into a number of other things. We're always trying to find new green ways to reuse, repurpose things. Woodbury, a few years back, switched from using just oil, started using pig fat in their menu. And at first, it was a real handling problem. We talked about it a few times, different things. I brought with me today, we actually started making soap out of that pig fat. So we separate the oil out. We still use the oil to make biofuels, but then we take that fat, which is more solid and easier to deal with, and we turn that into soap. So that's kind of what we focus on. You know, Matt's comes up with a lot of ideas. We try to come up with some ideas ourselves, and we're just trying to help each other out and make the best of things.
The relationship's basically I come up with the ideas and he has to make them work. So he's the brains.
Arona, just comment on just what happened yesterday with your new governor here in Maryland and action that he took, and then do I'd like you to comment on it because it involves chemicals.
Okay, well, I write a lot about chicken manure, so this I don't want to give too many details before we eat dinner. Basically, so we have a phosphorus problem in Maryland, and the phosphorus problem comes because farmers on the Eastern Shore have a lot of chicken manure, which they use as fertilizer, and they apply the fertilizer to the fields based on the nitrogen needs of the plants. And the phosphorus sort of comes along for the ride. And so a lot of the fields in Maryland have too much phosphorus on them. And we've known for a long time that this has been the case. And scientists for about 10 years have been trying to work on what used to be called an index and is now called a phosphorus management tool. And what that means is that there's a score. Your soil gets a score based on a test for phosphorus, but not just that. They look at your slopes, how close your fields are to the water, your drainage, all these issues, and they give you a score. And if your score is above 150, you cannot add any more phosphorus to your field. So that means if you have been fertilizing your field with chicken manure, you need to go to a commercial fertilizer, and that's going to cost you money. So this regulation called the PMT was stalled several times under Martin O'Malley, and it was put in shortly before he left office. And what happened yesterday, after a few hours after Governor Hogan was inaugurated, this thing was about to be published into the Maryland Register, and he had a deadline by 4 o'clock to pull it, and he pulled it. So now we don't know what is going to happen to phosphorus. The thing with oysters, and you know, this can be kind of confusing. I was down in Somerset County, and I had a county official tell me, "Well, you know, phosphorus is good for oysters." Oysters consume algae, and they consume plant life, but there is such a thing as too much. And if you give them too much, they will die. And that's one of the reasons why oysters are suffering in lots of parts of the country, including the Gulf of Mexico and Louisiana. They have a huge phosphorus problem from the Gulf of Mexico. They have other problems too, like an oil spill. Right. So they have this huge problem. They have salinity, they have diversions, they have an oil spill, they have Katrina. They got a lot of things going on, but the phosphorus is an issue. So in terms of what happens now, we don't know, but Hogan made a campaign promise that he was going to make this his first fight, and he did. But Maryland made a promise to the EPA that they were going to reduce phosphorus from ag. So how that is going to happen, I think, is still unclear right now. But the thing about the phosphorus management tool is that it was a very sort of measured set of options. It was not a sort of pass-fail test, but it was looked at very closely, and scientists spent a lot of time perfecting it. So,
would you like to hazard a guess on how an increase in phosphorus in the bay, how would that affect the health of the bay in general and not just oysters?
Yes. So Rona hit the nail on the head there. Too much of anything is a bad thing. I mean, too much water will kill a human. So you're looking at the same thing with phosphorus. And it really does need to be, like, it does need to be put back a step further. Like, he's trying to put it in perspective from the farmers, and everyone's trying to help the farmers, but it comes a step further, which is the industrial farming of the chickens. And the chicken manure that they're getting for free at that point is why they're using it. And if the chicken farmers, Purdue, Tyson, whoever, would just go the one step further and put that through a digester or something like that, they could then use the fertilizer on the back end of it, and most of that would not be as harmful. So I think it's a great issue to be focused on. If the attention was put in the correct place, maybe someone with a little bit more lobbying, it would be better dealt with.
Can I just add one thing to that? During this 4 years where we've been kind of fighting over phosphorus and the phosphorus management tool, one thing that was supposed to happen that didn't happen was we were supposed to be looking at manure to energy. Purdue has a facility in Delaware that takes excess manure and turns it into a pelletized product that goes into fertilizer. We were supposed to be looking at kind of a similar thing in Maryland, and it never really went anywhere. And the other thing that never went anywhere either was we were supposed to be looking at interim storage so that a farmer wouldn't just be out of luck with this load of manure and nowhere to take it, that there would be a place where he could store it for a while figured out what to do with it. And those things didn't happen, so we were left with a situation that the farmers were taken off guard, that suddenly, it seemed sudden to them, that suddenly they had to comply with this rule.
I want to change tack here, and any of the four panelists can comment on this. I just want to read a quote from a story we ran in Fruit Arts 2 years ago on shellfish farming, not just oyster farming, but mostly oysters. And this quote is from Rodney Clark, who has a Rodney's Oyster House in Toronto, one in Vancouver, and just 2 weeks ago opened a mammoth oyster house in Calgary. He owns oysters. He's a native of Prince Edward Island, and he's considered by many in the oyster community to be the godfather of modern oyster house. He is really, really knows as much about oysters as anybody on earth. And this is what he said. He's been in the oyster business almost 35 years now. He says, when I started out, oysters were at least 4 inches long or larger and shaped like a box. We sold four grades. Commercial, the lowest grade, was very long but very flat with no cup and inconsistent size. Standards, also long and narrow but with more of a cup, came in small sizes of 3 to 4 inches. Large came in at least 4 to 5 inches. Choice was so named. Choice because of their excellent symmetry, 1.5 times as wide as long, making them very popular in the restaurant trade, and also offered in small and large sizes of 3 to 4 inches and 4 to 6 inches. And finally, the forgotten fancy. The fancy oyster was a native of Prince Edward Island, a perfect shape, almost like a teardrop before it falls, and running from 5 to 10 inches in size. Alas, the great Malpighiu disease wiped out this colossal bivalve in around 1900, though they could still occasionally be found up to about 1982, along with the choice. Now all you get are commercials and standards because it takes too long to grow them out to the bigger sizes. Matt, like to comment on that?
Yeah, it's actually a function of a number of things Rona brought up as well. The oysters that we are growing are, I think, on their 36th or its 38th version of genetic manipulation for both our diploids and the triploids for a stronger, more disease-resistant oyster. The oysters we grow through paddle wheel upwellers, et cetera, grow very quickly. We can get them up to 3 inches, which is market, in a year. The problem is that you can let an oyster sit and grow another 2 years, and it can grow bigger. The issue is death. They'll still get killed off at some point by the disease because, again, they can't run away. They're just sitting there. So you can't really get them up to that size. And then the other part from the farming standpoint is if you can get an oyster to market at 3 inches and you can clear that cage and load it with seed again, you have a more rapid turnover of your farm product. So if you had a cage sitting there and it had to sit there for 3 years, you're really losing a lot of revenue. So size does matter. Some people do like small, petite oysters. Some raw bars that we deal with only want the biggest stuff that we can find, and they won't exactly be perfect. With what Dewey was talking about with the tumbler that we designed, it actually helps create a more symmetrical oyster and what we call on that a 321, which is 3 inches long, 2 inches wide, 1 inch cup. So if those things are, that would be considered the more perfect plating type oyster instead of, you know, a 4 or 5. I don't think, Spike, if you've guys ever served a 4 or 5 inch oyster here?
Only a couple.
Let me follow you, Spike, from your point of view, from the customer's point of view, have you ever heard a customer say, I want a big oyster?
Oh, yeah, everybody has their preferences, and I love the fact that when you serve an oyster in a restaurant like Woodbury, a lot of times you're tapping into a culture of oyster appreciation that goes back, you know, in this case, in our region, millennia. So, but the large oysters are, I think, largely a thing of the past. The big, big oysters that you're talking about, every once in a while a grower will find one and bring it to us just almost as a curiosity. When you see one of those big oysters, it's really, really impressive. But I don't think anybody expects or is really looking for that anymore, on a plate of rice.
Something else we haven't addressed, I mean, and there's one other aspect in this article about nomenclature of oysters. But the other thing is the shell, the half shell versus the shell trade. So can you explain how that works a little?
I mean, the half shell versus shucking?
Folks at Rappahannock Oyster Company down below you, that most of the shelled oysters are wild oysters.
You mean the shucked oysters?
Shucked oysters.
Yes.
They're clumped together.
We call them ugly shuckers. So, for example, we'll have some of those even in our cages where you would say, okay, I've got a farmed oyster, but because of one reason or another, it grew up next to Titum somebody, and they're too close together. And if I try to break them out on the boat, I'm going to kill one. So might as well just take those and sell those to a shucking house. Others are dredged oysters on managed beds. So you'll have... Lauren was mentioning putting down shell on the bottom. That shell comes from folks like Oyster Recovery Partnership or other shucking houses where you literally go and buy shell, and now it's like $3 a 5-gallon bucket. So if you see a big pile of oyster shells somewhere, you know, that's worth some money to the oyster farmer down on the water. So what they'll do is they'll put oyster shell down, and there are some really, really interesting methods by doing spat on shell. It's called spat on shell, where you actually take the living spat and you introduce it to a dead shell, it strikes and it becomes becomes an oyster, spat. There are a couple of places that are doing in situ spat on shell. Normally what they do is they have a giant tank, looks like an above-ground swimming pool. They have oysters in cages in there. They introduce about 4 to 8 million larvae. The oysters will strike after 3 or 4 days. They take the cages out, put it on a barge, fire hose that barge off onto their bottom land, killing half the babies with with a fire hose at the same time. Yeah. But there are some right now. There's some studies going on. I really would love to get into it. But an ability to pump larvae down to the bottom of the bay on top of the shell bed so they don't have to swim all the way down to get down there. Those oysters are the ones that are generally going to be your shucked oyster because it's not as pretty as a 321 for a half shell market. And then it's, you know, it's a managed bed. It's a managed place.
I'm going to read one more paragraph from the story. It says, another significant change in the business is the proliferation of names. Clark, who we just heard from before, is a strong advocate for standardizing nomenclature, arguing that all those different names are confusing. In France, they identify oysters by using their scientific names or an AOC, which is the Appellation d'Origine Contrôlée. Basically, it protects where the oyster came from. You know, it's like wines are AOC, a lot of products are. And another oyster man named Bob Rolfe up in Rhode Island concurs that there are way too many names and suggests that Appellation system might indeed make more sense. Still, it is the concept of miroir. If the concept of miroir is to mean anything, then using the specific place name rather than a region is an important aspect of selling the product. However confusing it may be to keep so many names straight. Rona.
Well, I like that oyster farmers are putting their own stamp on their product. I think it makes it more fun to eat. Like, you have Sweet Jesus oysters down in Hollywood. I mean, that's... And I asked the oysterman, how'd you come up with that name? He says, because when you eat them, you say, Sweet Jesus, that's good. And I thought, well, that's a cat, you know, that's a product that, you know, I mean, the oyster tastes good, but even if it didn't, you'd be intrigued, right? I mean, and I think I like the, I think it shows the creativity when they give them these names. And the Rappahannock oyster guys are really good at that. I mean, marketing and coming up with a name. And I think most oyster farmers are using the name of where the oyster is from in the name, like the Chop Tank Sweets, or what are your oysters called?
We have some that are, you know, like instead of Sweet Jesus, we have the OMG oyster. So if you like the little one, you like the bigger one. We also have Skipjacks, which are the traditional name. We do have some we call Double D's, which are the bigger, deeper oysters, deep and delicious.
It gets your attention, right?
It comes down to how do you differentiate yourself from somebody else? You know, if we all said, well, they're all Virginicus oysters, which is the East Coast standard name for the Virginicus crassostrea oyster, you wouldn't know one from another. So when you go into market your oysters, there'd be no differentiation. And the only problem with doing it by the body of water is the body of water, by law, is not trademarkable. So I could call an oyster I grab out of the Rappahannock a Rappahannock oyster, and there's nothing they can do about it. So so you have to have the Rappahannock stingray, or the they also have some old salts they sell from the Eastern Shore. So those are the only issues, really, is if you're trying to get a different name or marketing your name, it's hard to go by, you know, the scientific name. The other thing that Virginia's done is they went around and did it by salinity and by taste. So there are five zones that we're all classified in. So if you were to go to a Virginia bar and they'd say, well, where are you? I'd be able to pull out the map and go, we're zone 4 or 5, depending on which side of the point we're on. So that's kind of one of the ways they classify taste. And it has a whole little taste profile of, you know, butteriness, salinity, and all these other neato things.
There's one other person I want to introduce. Alan's here, but very important part of the Chesapeake Bay oyster industry, which is coming back, as we heard, and that is Brian Gomes of the Oyster Recovery Partnership. And I'm not going to read off this. You can tell everybody what the ORP does.
Thank you, Jim. I'm Brian with Oyster Recovery Partnership. We're based in Annapolis, Maryland. We have a partnership with the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science, Horn Point Lab Hatchery in Cambridge, Maryland, where the hatchery, where all the magic happens, where we do this large-scale restoration for the Chesapeake Bay. Since the organization was found in 1994, we put about 5.2 billion, with a B, oysters back into the Chesapeake Bay watershed on over 2,200 acres of oyster reef, which is a remarkable number. Last year it was alone about 900 billion. So with the wonders of science and technology, those numbers have really jumped up in the last few years. And a huge part of oyster restoration in the Bay's watershed is our shell recycling alliance that we launched 5 years ago, that Spike came on board in its inception. And we had 21 restaurants in Baltimore and Annapolis in 2010. And in the last 5 years, it's grown to about 225 restaurants in Virginia, DC, Maryland, and Delaware. We'll collect shells from restaurants like Woodbury. We'll get them back to the hatchery. They'll sit in the shell pile for about a year, get clean, dried, and aged. The sun, the rain, the flies, Mother Nature does its thing until they have a clean, dry substrate ready for action. And then we have fertile, disease-resistant broodstock oysters that are brought into the hatchery, put into spawning trays, raise the water temperature, play some Barry White music. The spawn, as I like to say.
Cocopelli dolls everywhere.
And we collect the seed. We move them to a huge tank in the back of the hatchery, where they're in a larval state for 2 to 3 weeks, when they are about to metamorphosize from free floating spat to actual, or free floating larva to spat. The scientists at the lab draw off about 2 million in a 5 gallon bucket, pour it over all that clean, dry shell, and a couple days later we have spat on shell that is attached to it want to pass that around. The two circled green spots are about a week or two old spat. Once it's attached to the shell, it gets loaded on the boat at the pier at Cambridge and chugs down the chop tank to wherever we're doing plantings in and around the bay. So that's a huge part of the restoration. Aquaculture is also a huge part because we love the farms. It takes the burden off the wild harvest. We can recycle farm shells as easily as we can in the wild. And it's above and beyond where you have sustainable with a fish farm. Oyster farming is actually restorative because they are, you don't feed them, and they are removing nutrients as they feed in the watershed. So it's a win-win-win.
Brian, doesn't that also help the pH of the bay?
Yes, calcium.
You know, there was some talk after Hurricane Sandy hit New York that if the oyster beds hadn't been so depleted there, that the effects of the storm wouldn't have been so severe. So now there is a push to restore oyster beds to New York Harbor in anticipation of the next 750-year storm. Okay, questions?
Do not speak.
Jim is my brother-in-law.
So he likes telling you not to speak.
This is a layman's question. Dana, my wife, and I were on Tillman Island by chance the first day of oyster season this year. And we happened to be biking by the dock as the boats were coming in. And we went down, and there were beautiful, massive oysters coming in. But the question, I guess, is I don't know whether they were, I assume they were Chesapeake Bay oysters. And it never crossed my mind that they might be producing oysters or non-producing oysters. And can you tell the difference? If you're buying an oyster or you're picking an oyster off the boat, how do you know which is which? And also, if this is happening, if you put 10 acres, set aside 10 acres, and you put both types of oysters in that area and you let them grow without harvesting them for 2 or 3 or 4 years, by the way, a 10-inch oyster, Ian and I both agree, would be way too much to handle.
Grill it.
But what would come out at the end of 3 or 4 years in terms of how many of both types would survive and how would they grow? And has anybody done that?
Actually, they've, for the most part, have not done that. The reason why is if you do introduce diploid oysters at the same place that you do your triploid oysters during the summertime, you'd have no way to be able to tell the two apart when you harvested them. So you might pick up
You can't tell.
You can't from just looking at it. You actually have to do a test. It's called a ploidy test. So they actually test the ploidy. Is it diploid? Is it triploid? They'll pull the chromosomes out and look at them. So there's no way to tell. So what they usually do is if someone is growing that 5%, for example, in Virginia, who might also be oyster gardeners, which we could talk about, if they are growing diploid oysters, they'll set one bed aside and just grow oysters that are diploids there and then triploids somewhere else. They know, I'm not touching this area in the summer when it's hot because they're all hot and bothered. I'm going to go over here and harvest my triploids.
To the first part of your question, if you saw boats coming in at that area where the Naps Narrows is, if you saw boats coming in, those were guys who were in the wild fishery. And depending on what time of year you saw them, they were fishing in the bay, or they were going to the Nanticoke, or they might have been going to Tangier Sound. When they pull up to the dock like that, those are the wild catch. And I don't think there's an oyster farm on Tillman Island right now. I don't know if anyone knows of one. I don't know of one.
No, these were coming in out of the bay.
Yeah, so those were, yeah, those were wild.
Dredged, yeah.
Okay. Another question?
Do you get your seed from Horn Point?
I do not. We're a Virginia farm, so in order to bring it from Horn Point, I'd have to have it tested for diseases. There are a number of hatcheries, very successful hatcheries in Virginia. Started basically with VIMS, the Virginia Institute of Marine Science, which is part of William & Mary. And they basically have gone to Oyster Seed Holdings. A couple other guys that we would buy our larvae from. We actually buy larvae before seed. So we'll actually do exactly what Brian was talking about, but in a smaller environment, and we'll just drive 2 to 3 million oyster larvae in a thing that looks like a giant pizza tray, actually, down onto microculch, so ground up to about 500 micron shell. And then we take that and we grow it out and grow it in various sized trays until it's big enough to go out in one of the cages. But I've been there. It's a very nice facility.
Mm-hmm. Do you ship your oysters on ice, or do you can them or hermetically seal them?
Oh, if they're shucked oysters, they're shipped in sealed containers. We do ship all the way out to Las Vegas, for example, weekly. And those are shipped in refrigerated, or they look like coolers with a lot of ice packs in them. We track our temperatures a few times a year on shipping using DeltaTrack USB thermographs. So literally it's something that's a little bit bigger than what you'd stick in your computer for a temporary storage device. But you throw that in the crate, and every 30 seconds it goes, what's temperature recorded? What's temperature recorded? And you'll be able to see the temperature over time of that shipment, so you don't have a situation where, for example, Vibrio vulnificus, which will make someone sick, or if you're sick, it could kill you. So you want to keep that oyster right down underneath 45 degrees at all times.
That is the sterilization process as there is for clams.
I'm sorry, say it again.
Is there a sterilization process as there is for clams?
There isn't on a wild catch or even on an aquaculture catch, unless you wanted to go to what's called a depuration tank, which is you can take oysters from contaminated water and you can stick them in a tank, introduce filtered clean water, and after a few days they're clean and you take them out and they can be sold. But that's the only way you'd actually clean, if you will, the oyster on the inside.
But there is a rule now that they, in the summer, that aquaculture oysters have to be under refrigeration by, is it 10 o'clock in the morning?
Depends on where you are. For us, we have to be underneath refrigeration. We have to be back to the dock by 10. So if you get up at light, you have to be back by 10, and you have a certain number of hours to get that oyster, which is sitting in 75-degree water. So it's warm when it's coming out, and you've got to ice that. We ice to get it down. Otherwise, you know, if you stick it in a refrigerator, it's going to take a while for that oyster to get chilled out. And an oyster will, as it filters, it has Vibrio coming into it, it has dirt coming into it, it has, you know, food coming into it, and it emits a thing called pseudo-feces, which is just whatever it ate and it couldn't digest, it just throws out. But once you get it out of the water and it closes, it doesn't have the ability to eject that. So it basically becomes a sealed petri dish, and if you leave it getting warm, the bacteria and stuff just grows and grows and grows and grows and grows. So that's why you can't eat a warm oyster.
Right.
So I have a question, Ronan, that you might be able to answer. I live in Mount Washington here in Baltimore, and the house is about 100 years old, and no matter where I dig in the garden, I find oyster shells. Do you think that's because they brought them in to condition the soil, or is it just left over from people who were partying and shucking oysters?
Well, it's odd that would be the case in Baltimore. You see a lot of that on the Eastern Shore. A few years ago, I was doing a story in an old button factory, and the whole parking lot of the button factory was made out of oyster shells, and the buttons were made out of oyster shells as well. So they had, and the whole city of Crisfield is made on oyster shells. Norfolk, Virginia, was built on oyster shells. A lot of driveways on the Eastern Shore and probably Northern Neck of Virginia too are made with oyster shells. It's not something you see that it's that common over here, but it's crazy because now there's such a shortage of shell. But at one time, we had so much of it, we were just throwing it on driveways. So I think that's probably what it's from.
But this is not crushed. These are whole shells. But that's what they did.
They used to throw those down. Just you'd take a dump truck and dump oyster shell down. That's what you'd use for your driveway. But, you know, before Brian has a heart attack, you know, we'll say that, please don't do that.
Right, yeah.
Better ways to recycle your shell.
Yeah, related. I have a slightly related question. I was fortunate enough, there were five people, we were five at my house on Christmas Eve, and one of the people there brought us a peck of oysters. And we bagged the shells up afterwards, and I was about to take them out to the recycling, and the person who brought them said, no, I'll take them back to the oyster place where I got them. So is that what, as a consumer, we should be doing with our oyster shells, or throwing them out in the backyard, or?
He wants to answer that one.
So our Shell Recycling Alliance, the Oyster Recovery Partnership, has weekly pickup from restaurants throughout the region, and we also have public drop sites. So if you go to the website, shellrecycling.org, you can find the municipalities where you can drop shell. In a pinch, feel free to call our office, and we can, we're in Baltimore 2 days a week. So
if anyone ever brings me a pack of oysters again,
please save the shells and don't throw them in your driveway.
I have two questions. First of all, relatively speaking, the Maryland, Virginia area, what percentage of oysters that go to market are wild oysters and what percentage are farm raised? And I remember many years ago when I graduated college, I went cross country. I went to Washington State and had oysters there, which I thought were absolutely terrible.
Pacificus gigas.
Yeah, but
that's the oyster that brought in the MSX gigas.
Are they doing the same thing out there? Or are they farming out there as well as on the East Coast?
I'll take the second one first. Yes, they are farming on the West Coast. A lot of them do farming there. As far as the first part, I can answer for Virginia. 2 years ago, aquaculture oysters outpaced dredged oysters in sales for the first time in history, and the trajectory is just insanely up.
Absolutely.
So you can control your environment more. One of the things, we talked about the diseases that eat oysters. Crabs are the number one killers, and that and Spike and I were talking beforehand, the cow-nosed ray, the dreaded cow-nosed ray. So this ray comes up from, and this is one of those, the law of unintended consequences. We go, our people go down into the Bahamas and they sport fish and they catch sharks. Those sharks were not eating the cow-nosed rays. So the cow-nosed
on the food chain.
They're down on the food chain. So what happens is, actually it's about June 15th, you can almost clock it. From an airplane, you can watch these rays. They look like a big swarm of bats flying into the bay, and the first thing they do is land on an oyster reef, and they can crunch an adult natural oyster. They sit there like a mess of crazy bats. So there are actually cow-nosed ray tournaments on my river, and the winning boat makes $5,000.
Wow.
I mean, this is like, get them, we got to get the numbers down. So,
can we eat them?
You can, but you got to do a lot of work to it.
Hey, I've had lionfish.
Nice.
Get my bit there.
So, aquaculture is outpacing dredge for a number of reasons. One is you can control your environment. You can try to keep the crabs up, but I can tell you, a crab can get in, into your cage at half an inch, and it molts and it grows and it eats algae, molts and grows and eats algae. And if you don't get that cage up in 3 months and look and get the crabs out, it'll wipe out your entire. I've had many of a $1,500 crab, I can tell you. When you pull up a cage and all you see, it sounds like cornflakes coming to the surface, and you look down, and there's a 6-inch Jimmy sitting there like, what? I was just sitting here eating. It's like, you're going in the pot. So, if you get the cages up, you can manage that versus if those oysters are just naturally on the bottom, crabs just go along and wipe out whatever they wipe out. It's just a numbers game.
So sort of a follow-up. In terms of the regulatory environment, do you feel that the government is supporting you, or do you feel a lot of resistance toward aquaculture for oysters?
I can only speak to Virginia because I don't do aquaculture. In Maryland, Virginia is extremely pro-aquaculture, and they'll do just about anything they can do to support you. You work with a number of government regulation agencies. You've got VMRC that manages the bottom land, and they have satellite photos of catching people, making sure people aren't poaching somebody else's bottom land, if you will. You also have shellfish sanitation, part of the health department, that monitors when our oysters came out, what temperature they were after 4 or 5 hours, et cetera. But they're all good people saying, hey, look, we're just trying to help everyone else out. Last thing any of us want is anyone to get sick off of an oyster and,
it down. I can answer that part for Maryland, too. At the beginning, when the law was changed, it was still very difficult to get an oyster farm up and running. The difference, as Matt said, Virginia is very pro-oyster farming. They see the benefits, both for business and for the environment. And Maryland has tried very, very hard, the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, to make it easy for oyster farmers to get into the business, but they still have a lot of hurdles, including the Army Corps of Engineers, which has to issue the permit for the oysters. And they got this joint permit, but the Army Corps still needs to review it. And so The goal in Maryland was for an oyster lease to take about 3 months, which is about how long it takes in Virginia from when you apply to when you get it. But in Maryland, it's taking 6 months, sometimes a year. And in Maryland also, we're encountering some protests. There's kind of on two fronts. Sometimes a neighbor doesn't want an oyster farm in front of their home if they bought a property on the shore. And then the other problem that we're having, this is happening right now in the Chestertown area, is a young man wants to start an oyster farm, and he's encountering resistance from watermen who don't want an oyster farm there. And one of the reasons they don't want an oyster farm there is because it's an area where they have in the past caught razor clams, which is a bait clam, and they're worried that taking this area out of their razor clam harvest area will harm them. So there are all kinds of issues in Maryland that make it slower. And as a result, to answer the question you initially asked, the wild harvest in Maryland is still larger than the aquaculture harvest. And at one day, it could outstrip like Virginia has. That happened very quickly.
Yeah. Four and 5 years.
Yeah, it was dramatic. So it could happen here. Virginia also has what they call faster water, though, which is the saltier water, so the oysters do grow faster there.
I want to answer one part of your question. They do a lot of aquaculture on the West Coast, particularly in Washington State and British Columbia. And one of the world's largest operations is the Taylor Shellfish Company in Washington. They do various kinds of oysters. And I think maybe 10, 15 years ago, they started raising the East Coast oyster, which is now one of their best sellers and acknowledged to be the best tasting oyster of their entire operation.
So a comment for Spike and Dewey. Wanted to applaud what you're doing with the waste oil from your kitchens. In my day job, I spent a lot of time worrying about carbon and climate at NASA. What you're doing is the right way to make biodiesel, which is off of a waste oil product. And I would have been horrified if you had told me that you were making it out of soy or something like that, sort of food crop. So just kudos on that.
Thank you.
I understand that in Washington State, the Taylor farming people out there have already begun to notice problems with oyster aquaculture because of increasing acidification, ocean acidification, and they've had to change some of select species or organisms that would grow better under these circumstances. And my question is, have we noticed any change in this problem of ocean acidification on the Atlantic coast with the oyster growing?
Yeah, if I could step in from a chemical standpoint there, a lot of your acidification in the oceans is due to CO2. So the air can absorb so much, but water is actually better absorbing CO2. CO2 is acidic. There's a number of waste plants that actually bubble CO2 into plants, into waste processes to provide acidity. So that's where a lot of that's coming from. So a lot of that's linked.
I can actually address that.
I'm not the scientist. I'm an outreach guy.
Right. So the ocean acidification issue that the West Coast fisheries are facing, a lot of it is from upwelling of deep water from the deep part of the Pacific Ocean, which is very cold. It is very old, and it has a lot of CO2 in it from the decomposition of organic matter over millennia, actually. And some of the changes in ocean circulation are bringing this deep water up into the West Coast fisheries, and it's dissolving the shellfish in front of people's eyes.
But in the Atlantic,
we don't have that same circulation pattern, and we're not going to have that same process happening here.
I think it's La Nina.
not what they're seeing on the West Coast. I'm not saying that there isn't ever going to be a pH problem.
We don't have that
deep water and the cold upwelling here.
Maryland started, I think, last year. They had an ocean acidification task force summer study, and they were looking at the issue because they do think that it's going to be an issue here. And the report just came out yesterday, and I have your email, so I will send it to you. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but they did just complete the report.
On the laying of oyster spat into estuaries and into the bay, have we seen, you said, close to a billion oysters at the lake, but have you seen progress as to the coverage on the, and where have you seen progress, and how much of it have you seen? Anybody?
I can answer, but oyster recovery guy is probably better.
Hi, Brian.
There was a system in place back for decades where the county oyster committees would kind of tell the Department of Natural Resources where they wanted natural oyster bars where they could harvest and where they wanted sanctuaries. And so maybe not surprisingly, the areas that were deemed sanctuaries were the areas that were not great for growing oysters. They were sort of the barren bottom areas. At one point, maybe only 10% of the oysters in the bay were in sanctuaries. But that's changed now. And Martin O'Malley had, I think, 25% of the oysters in sanctuaries. And he did also change some sort of a regulation so that you can have an oyster farm in an oyster sanctuary. That's allowed in Maryland. I think what they and Brian can explain this probably better than I can, but they went from sort of small patches of restoration to large areas of restoration, and the large areas of restoration seem to be working out a lot better, in part because success breeds success, especially with oysters, and with planting oysters that do well in such large numbers, you have a natural spat that's occurring in the water that sort of gravitates off of that. So I think the efforts have been much more successful in the last 5 years than they were in the previous couple decades.
Two things with restoration. One is the sanctuaries used to be in a river. You would have this reef is off limits, this reef is harvestable, and then management of that is a mess. So now an entire river watershed is closed, like the Severn River around Annapolis, that entire watershed is closed. And they are doing the same kind of management for restoration. So right now we're just finishing up the third and final year of the Little Shop Tank River over on the Eastern Shore. And that was a massive project where you can work, as I was saying, the whole watershed and have large scale results. So that's part of it. And then the wild harvest is another way to kind of look at the uptick is 3 years ago, the wild harvest was about 100,000 bushels. 2 years ago, it was about 450,000 bushels. And the numbers coming out for this past season will be up again. So we're making progress and all that helps.
Okay. All those in favor of eating oysters now, say aye.
Aye.
All those who want to thank our panelists, say thank you.
Thank you.
So we've got a tremendous supper for you all. Opie, our chef from Woodbury, has been here all night. Oysters will be prominently featured in fritters, in a baked dish, in some just straight-ahead classic oyster stew, and a couple other things. I really thank you guys for being here. It's inspiring to see all the interest and passion around this. And we'll be doing this again. I really thank these guys. Brian and this guy here, I've learned so much. And Rona, I felt like I've got a whole new chapter to get into. So this is what we do at Woodbury. You know, it's great because, you know, the conversation starts with oysters, but it leads to biodiesel and it leads to phosphorus and all these other things, all of which we're trying to wrap our heads around. I hope you've been suitably educated or whatever, and now you're going to get fed. So,
thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks again for joining us tonight at Artifacts for our Origin Speaker Series. With thanks to Dana Slater for producing the program, Hannah Reagan for her masterful coordination, and particular thanks to Lou Mann, Mark Eldridge, Dennis Greensfelder, and Dakota Keaton from the Broadcasting Institute of Maryland for recording this evening's conversation. We're grateful to be partnering with Heritage Radio in Brooklyn, New York for creating a home for the Origin Speaker Series.